Good evening, everyone. I know that people are tuning in from California, New York, Florida, and so many other states. So thank you for taking the time to join us as we engage in a conversation surrounding a very important incident in Tulsa, Oklahoma's history. For those that may not know me, my name is Amanda Chestang, and I am the diversity officer at the University of Tulsa here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I will be co-moderating tonight's event alongside Dr. Dale Caldwell. Before I provide a brief overview of the evening and introduce our panelists and guests, I would like to thank Glenn Best, Executive Director of the Black Entrepreneurship Hall of Fame, Sheila Curry, Executive Director of the Black Tennis Hall of Fame, James Howard, Executive Director of the Black Inventors Hall of Fame, and Dr. Dale Caldwell, founder of the Black Tennis, Entrepreneurship, and Inventors Hall of Fames, for helping to develop and kick off the first event of our series titled Black Wall Street: The Past, Present, and Future of Black Excellence. It has been a true honor to collaborate and work with you all. In a moment, I will pass the spotlight to our terrific panelists to introduce themselves. And as we have a wide range of audience members attending tonight, after introductions, we would like to show a short video surrounding Tulsa's Black Wall Street and the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre to provide some historical context before engaging in the panelist question and answer portion of the event. We will conclude the evening by hearing from Glenn, Sheila, James, and Dale, describing the mission of the various Hall of Fames and how we can honor and support previous, current, and future leaders who have and continue to build up Tulsa's Greenwood District. So with that being said, Dr. Adewale, as a fellow member of the TU community, would you like to start us off and just briefly talk about your title and involvement in this work related to Black Wall Street and the 1921 race massacre?
Thank you, Amanda, and thank you for everyone as part of this panel that invited me to be speaking tonight. But I also just wanted to say that this is a wonderful event to kick off this discussion to center it around Black excellence, so I appreciate that. But my name is Dr. Alicia Odewale, and I'm an assistant professor at the University of Tulsa in the Department of Anthropology. And I come at this wearing a few different hats, one as an academic, but as an archaeologist specifically, and someone who researches specifically the archaeology of Black life in the past. So my expertise is specifically doing new geophysical and archaeological research in Greenwood itself to search for remaining structures that are part of the 100-year journey from after the massacre till today. So telling that 100-year story is a lot to do with actually uncovering history that's underground. So I'm part of that work, but also a member of the physical investigation team that's part of the City of Tulsa search for mass graves.
Thank you, Dr. Adewale. Phil Armstrong, would you like to go next?
Good evening to everyone and to fellow panelists. It's an honor to be here. It's an honor for TU to be so proactive and with intentionality really show their passion for this history and this work. This actually just 2 weeks ago, I was on a panel for the TU Alumni Association to discuss this and to share the history information. So it's great to have this collaborative partner right here in Tulsa, just a short couple mile drive from historic Greenwood. My name is Phil Armstrong. I'm the project director for the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission. We have several committees that we have in play and are planning, most namely a building of an 11,000 square foot facility that will be called Greenwood Rising, which will be the Black Wall Street History Center that we plan to dedicate and have open by the centennial next May. And again, it's an honor to be on this panel with you.
Thank you, Phil. And lastly, Dr. Reverend Turner, would you like to go next?
Hi, greetings. I'm Robert Turner, pastor of Historic Vernon African Methodist Episcopal Church that sits 307-311 North Greenwood. I'm sitting right now in my office at that same location. So honored to be here. I sit on various boards and committees across the city, not the least of which being the Mass Grace Public Oversight Committee that is overseeing the excavation of the mass graves.
Thank you so much, Dr. Turner. And thank you to all of our panelists for taking the time to join us and share your expertise in your key areas. Tulsa's Greenwood District, also known as Black Wall Street, was a thriving community filled with over 300 Black-owned businesses, including offices for doctors and lawyers, movie theaters, grocery stores, hotels, pool halls, banks, tailors, and they even had their own school system. The increasing wealth and success of Black Wall Street was a true manifestation of Black inventions, entrepreneurship, and culture. But as Black Wall Street continued to thrive, many in the local white community became resentful, which ultimately resulted in the destruction of Black Wall Street. We will now transition to a short video developed by USA Today to provide a brief overview of the events leading up to and the aftermath of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, as told by a narrator and Dr. Olivia J. Hooker, survivor of the massacre. The photographs displayed in the video were made available by the Tulsa Historical Society and Museum and the University of Tulsa's McFarland Library Archives. Some of these images and Dr. Hooker's firsthand recollections may be hard to view and hear, but I invite you to reflect on Dr. Hooker's words and recognize that the images taken almost 100 years ago are very similar illustrations of the incidents happening in our society today.
We generally call it the catastrophe because we feel like it wasn't a riot. We didn't. We were not the perpetrators. We were the victims. But it took 80 years to get the state of Oklahoma to acknowledge that.
The Tulsa Race Massacre is believed to be one of the worst incidents of racial violence in American history. From May 31st to June 1st, 1921, as many as 300 people were killed, hundreds were injured, and thousands of buildings were destroyed.
On June 1st, they began to systematically destroy neighborhoods, and they had airplanes dropping things down on people's houses, and they had made up their minds to clear the entire area of Black people.
It started after a newspaper reported a Black man tried to sexually assault a white woman. Though it's still uncertain what exactly happened, many did not believe that story. The Oklahoma Historical Society said the most common explanation is Dick Rollins stepped on Sarah Page's foot when he entered the elevator, causing her to scream. A group of armed Black men went to the courthouse to offer help protecting Rowland once they heard talks of lynching. A crowd of white men was also on the scene. A shot was fired and the riots began.
My parents were very distressed because here they are with five kids and the schools had been. I went to Dunbar School and that was reduced to just rubble. I mean, they blew it up.
Crowds of white rioters went to the Greenwood District, known as Black Wall Street. It was home to an affluent African-American community with banks, hotels, theaters, and new homes.
They took my eight-year-old brother, too, where they were holding all the Black men. And we didn't know because we lived on one side of town and they lived on the other. We thought they were locking up the non-Blacks, too. But it so happened that it didn't occur that way. What they did was to disarm and lock up all Black men. And then they said to the mob, there's nothing out there now but women and children, so you can do whatever you want to do. And that was when the real terrible things started to happen.
It ended when the city was placed under martial law and National Guard troops were deployed. But Black Wall Street was devastated. Survivors never received compensation for what they lost.
Okay, so to further engage with this history and discuss current initiatives, Dale, would you like to start us off with the first question for our panelists?
Yes. And again, I'm Dr. Dale Caldwell. I am a professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University, and I'm the executive director of the Rothman Institute of Innovation and Entrepreneurship. And it's just an honor to be here. And Dr. Oduwale, I'll start with you. What was Greenwood before the race massacre? Can you describe what it was? And I'm going to ask each of you to give your perspective on what it was back in 1921.
Yeah, and I can say that there's been multiple different perspectives on what Greenwood was, especially depending on if you're looking at contemporaneous, say, newspapers at the time, because the Black newspapers reporting on this have a completely different take on what Greenwood was versus the white newspapers that are circulating at the time, especially the Tulsa Tribune. So you'd have people describe Greenwood as, you know, Negro Wall Street when Booker T. Washington is visiting at the time. But you also have the Tulsa Tribune who described this neighborhood as a place of sin and debauchery and brothels and all sorts of things that were they're claiming to be a problem in Greenwood. And so the term Little Africa is coming from this derogatory sort of space to make Greenwood look like the problem that Tulsa needs to solve, quote unquote. But for other people who are actually residents of Greenwood or people who have seen this place for the value that it has as a safe haven from racial violence across the country, this is a completely different take. So it depends on kind of who you ask as to what Greenwood was and is.
Phil, would you answer that?
Yes, the thing that really encourages, or I should say, if this is an appropriate term, really excites me is when people get to hear the history of Greenwood prior to a Greenwood. What led to this African-American enclave of just entrepreneurial excellence? There's some had something to build up to that. And so when you go back in time and back in history and are able to tell them, you know, even long before the land run of 1889, the intermingling, the freedmen of the Native American tribes, the Native American tribes that owned slaves, slaves of African descent, when they brought them with them to Oklahoma during the Trail of Tears and the Indian Removal Act of 1830, when they settled, and in 1865, we know about Juneteenth, but it wasn't till June the 14th, 1866, a whole year later after Juneteenth, that the Muscogee Creek Nation released their slaves of African descent. And when they did, they gave them their fair share allotment of land, those that could tie their blood lineage, freedmen blood lineage that intermingled and had children married with the Indian native tribes. And they received anywhere from 40 to 200 acres of land. And that was all throughout the Muscogee Creek Nation, the Seminole, the Cherokee Nation. And so you have this immediate access to land. And when you owned land, you had wealth. And in the proliferation of the historic all-Black towns of Oklahoma, over 50 towns were established from Langston, where Langston University is, Redbud, Muskogee, and the list goes on and on and on. So you have Black-owned home ownership, properties, banks, businesses, all before you even get to Greenwood, all before the land run of 1889. Black folks and Native Americans were running Oklahoma to the extent, and here's another eyebrow-raising moment that we didn't hear in our history books, to the extent so much that in 1883, Edwin P. McCabe, he was a Black settler, he was from Arkansas, an attorney, he was very pivotal in getting African-Americans in these towns to run for political office. He actually started having discussions with our nation's government to possibly look at Oklahoma becoming an all-Black state. Wow. It was actually that discussion taking place. Again, Edwin P. McCabe in 1883, that Oklahoma would be an all-Black state. So that's really what brought Booker T. Washington here in 1905 when he visited all these black towns, and he was the first to say, it's like Negro Wall Street. That's where that term came from him coining that phrase. So what was Greenwood? Greenwood, prior to Greenwood, was a proliferation of all black communities, homes, towns, businesses that led to this creation of this economic enclave called Greenwood.
Wonderful, wonderful. Reverend Turner, you want to answer that? Then Amanda has a question.
I really just ditto what the previous two speakers mentioned about what Greenwood was, especially as it relates to the land received from the allotments and the impact that had the black townships. And really, the only thing I could add is that it was a self-made place for African Americans. This was at a time in this country where there was no such thing as affirmative action. There was no such thing as welfare or inner city small business loan development, Pell Grants. It was still against the law in most of America for black people to know how to read. You know, it was still against the law. But here in Greenwood, you had black doctors, black lawyers, black dentists, black bankers. I mean, you had everything. And so it was this place that defied all odds. Just two generations out of slavery. Two generations out of slavery, you had a community of people that had everything, not just that any black person would want, but you had everything any American would want right here in Greenwood. I mean, it was so prosperous, and I got to say this, this anecdotal, but it shows just the level of wealth. We had at least six families in Greenwood in 1921 that had their own airplanes. Like, you find a place with 10,000 black people today where six families own their own airplanes. We're not talking about automobiles, and they had several of those. We had six families in this district of 10,000 people in 1921 that owned their own airplanes.
Wonderful.
And it just goes to show and really reiterate that Greenwood District was for black people, built by black people. I don't know if I could illustrate this any better than how Greenwood was described. And so my next question kind of transitions to the massacre. So I'm going to actually start with Phil, if you don't mind. How did you first learn about the 1921 race massacre, if you did even learn about it? And was it referred to as a riot, or was it referred to as a massacre? And then in addition to that question, in your own opinion, why is it so important to use the term massacre versus riot?
Excellent questions. And I'll first start by saying, just like Reverend Turner on this, we are not Tulsa natives. I myself am originally born and raised in a small farm town in Ohio, and had the opportunity to attend a historically black college, HBCU, called Central State University in Wilberforce, Ohio. There are only two HBCUs in Ohio. They're right across from the street from each other. Just like most land grant institutions of higher learning for HBCUs, it's out in the middle of nowhere, like Langston. And you have Wilberforce University on one side of the street and Central State. And so I was a sophomore back in 1991, and one of my professors spent an entire semester in 1991 talking about Boley, Oklahoma, talking about Langston, and showed us a documentary on what it was called then, the 1921 Tulsa Race Riot in Greenwood. So we spent a whole semester learning about that back in 1991. When I moved here in 1997, it was, and I say this all the time, it was shocking that the only really discussion about this history was a three-day music festival called Juneteenth. It was actually alarming that, you know, I was walking around thinking, you guys don't know your history, but then realizing that there was a systematic covering up and not teaching this history in all of Oklahoma. So, you know, I learned it before moving here, and it's ironic that I find myself 23 years later being a part of this wonderful work. Race and massacre and race riot. So the commission You know, early on, one of the first things that the community, and this commission was founded by State Senator Kevin Matthews, African-American, back in 2015. He was the only African-American state senator serving at that time in, and we're, hey, let's face it, we're in Oklahoma, a very conservative state. And he began having those discussions and conversations and reaching across the aisle. But after the commission was formed in early 2018, the community, especially North Tulsa citizens, started telling the commission, you really want to gain some credibility, you really want to earn the trust of the community, then you change this name and start calling it what it really was, and that's a massacre. What the power in when you label something, the legal consequences, when the Tulsa Tribune and the authorities and the mayor called this a Negro uprising or a riot, calling it that caused then a legal clause to be gained by the insurance companies to not pay out any claims because it was labeled a riot. What we learn and what we discuss among the commission and what we try to teach, we pull this from the local historian, Hannibal B. Johnson, who's the resident expert, been studying this for 30 years, has written 10 books on this. Using his language, he said, you know, this could be, you could have used a number of ghastly descriptors to describe what took place. You could have called this a Holocaust because of the fire and the destruction with the fire. You could have called it a disaster. You could have called this a massacre, in which that was the chosen term by the community. You could have called this a pogrom, which is technically, academically, what it's called, a pogrom. You could have called it an ethnic cleansing, if you will. Mm-hmm. Any of these numbers. But the last thing that it should have been called was a riot. A riot, as we see sometimes in our current day settings, is when individuals within their own community rise up and do destruction. An entirely different community invaded this community and destroyed it. And so the first thing we did is said, we're no longer acknowledging this as a riot. And even in our current logo, if you look at our logo, we have the word riot slashed through and we leave it there on purpose with massacre underneath. So that sparks conversation. It gives us an opportunity to educate and enlighten. We're not changing history. We're not rewriting history. We're actually giving it the accurate description that it should have been called back in 1921.
Thank you. Dr. Adewale, Dr. Reverend Turner, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I can add that I'm a native Tulsan. So being born and raised here, I guess I come from a different perspective. And that the first time I'm hearing about this was not from school, it was from my family. And the first time I did hear about it in school was in high school at Booker T. Washington, when Miss Barbara Coleman, who has since passed on, she made sure we learned about this in her Oklahoma history class. But she had to go against the curriculum to make sure she's covering this history. And a lot of teachers at the time were kind of taking it upon themselves to cover it when it's not part of the curriculum. And unfortunately, a lot of people, they don't have individual teachers who are doing that sort of advocacy work. They never hear about this. And so both at the K through 12 and in college level, I mean, I still get people in my classes today who have never heard about this at teaching at TU. So there's still a lot of work we have to do to definitely just make sure it's in our curriculum across the board. But for me personally, I agree with everything that Phil just shared, that there's so many different words you can use to describe this event. But for me personally, I don't actually connect to the massacre label, just because it is more of a passive context. It doesn't describe the defense, the strategic defense of Greenwood. And so I describe it as an attack, because it was an attack from an outside force, but it was met with resistance. It was met with defense. It was met with this commitment to protecting life and liberty and your personhood and everything that was built here. So, I mean, it was more than just a massacre in my eyes. It was more like an attempted genocide that was met with fierce resistance. And who knows how many lives were saved because of the actions of Black veterans at the time, and primarily veterans from World War I. So, I mean, there's so much that we can learn if we, again, look back at the history. But there's so many different words that can describe this, but definitely riot is not one of them. And I should mention also that riot was also, it also affected the aid that came in the aftermath. So when they called it a riot, when they called it an uprising, the Red Cross technically was not even supposed to be called out to provide relief funds or relief in that aid, because they do not respond to events of riots. They respond to events of like mass disasters, especially nature or man-made disasters that are not seen as, you know, something of your own design. So there was actually impacts, not just for insurance, but for actually getting relief after the fact.
Thank you. Reverend Dr. Turner, do you have anything to add before we ask the next question?
Yeah, no, I just, I heard about it when I was a student at the University of Alabama in my African-American history class. And then when I was a student at law school at the University of Alabama, one of our professors, actually one of my professors was on the lawsuit with Professor Charles Ogletree. His name was Al Brophy. And he wrote a book about it as well. And so that's really when I first heard about it. And got a lot more intimate knowledge about the reparations lawsuit from him. And yeah, the language matters. I'm a pastor, so words definitely matter. You know? I mean, we believe that God spoke the earth into existence by just words. So I think that the nuance, which is a very significant difference between riot and massacre, it means a great deal. I mean, you've already heard it be stated. It was the reason why the residents who filed insurance claims were all denied. All the black residents were denied. The white person did get his who owned a pawn shop, but it was used against us for several decades. And it was used to kind of shame this black community, to make us feel as though we destroyed our own houses, our own schools, our own banks. And, you know, even like as in back then, once something is printed in the media, people believe it even more so then than now. You know, now that was before the whole term fake news originated, you know, so people thought if the Tulsa Tribune called it a riot, hey, that's what it was. You know, if the man on the radio called it a riot, hey, that's what it was. Well, sorry, baby, we can't get our insurance claim because these black folks have started to riot. And that's, we blamed ourselves. We fought internally amongst ourselves because we were listening to what they called it. And so that was very disheartening.
Thank you.
One of the things before I ask my next question, the term that comes to mind is terrorism.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is terrorism. And yeah. I remember looking at Wikipedia and seeing it was a race riot like 10 years ago. And then recently I looked and it's a massacre. And so, you know, so first to talk to, and Phil, I don't know if you guys changed that, but talk to terrorism, because, you know, this ties into the question I'm going to ask. Have you considered, because it is terrorism, and that means something in America right now.
Dr. Cole, actually, the conversations that Senator Matthews started having, because this is the second commission. You know, historically, the first commission was in 1997, led by State Senator Don Ross State Representative Don Ross and State Senator Maxine Horner led those efforts for the first bipartisan commission. And they looked specifically into discovering and researching the damages, the cost of the damages. That's where the amounts that they were discovered and the claims that were not filed that are at historic Greenwood Cultural Center on their the memorial that's out front of their center. That's where all that came from. And that actually did the research into reparations, initial discovery of and suggestions for how this, they did show that the state, the police department, the government were complicit and that they offered recommendations for reparations. Wow. And as you can see, we're still fighting for those today. They never followed on through. But in 2015, what was happening is the state of Oklahoma was sitting back and saying the 25th anniversary of one of the worst case of domestic terrorism and the bombing of the Oklahoma City Murrah Federal Building, we need to prepare and plan for a 25th acknowledgement of that. And Senator Matthews, to his credit, started challenging them and said, well, you do realize that this is not the first time that a bombing took place in Oklahoma. And he said, in fact, you know, almost 100 years ago, you know, the worst case of domestic terrorism took place when Americans dropped bombs on their fellow Americans in a place called Greenwood. That's really what, and so 100 years has come. Y'all talking about 25 years, 100 years, what are we going to show for that? That's really what made people sit down and said, oh my gosh, we do need to talk more. That really was the birth of, you know, the 2015 commission, using those words that they were describing other events, this was the worst case of domestic terrorism in United States history. So
wonderful. It's so great to have this history. And today is a special, I mentioned before in the pre that my dad, Reverend Dr. Gilbert H. Caldwell, passed away in September. Today is his birthday. And he knew in March with Dr. King and so on. And there's this other thing going on next week. I can't remember election. I think. and that's my next question is, and I'll start with Reverend Turner has gone last, but how much pushback? You know, we're in a time when there are good people on all sides, supposedly, and you know, and this is one of the most embarrassing things that's ever happened in America. And have you had pushback? And I'll start with Reverend Turner and then Dr. Adewale, and then Phil.
First of all, condolences to you and your family as we remember your father who passed away a year ago today. And it says a lot about you to be still doing this work on his day of that he transitioned.
Well, it's actually his birthday today. He died.
Oh, birthday. Wow. That's even more special.
It would have been his 87. But this, he would have loved this. He would have loved this, I'm telling you.
Well, that brings joy to my heart. And sadly, yes, I have received pushback. I mean, physical, really, yeah. Received pushback. Not just, I mean, you, of course, as Phil can state, you know, being from outside of Tulsa, you're going to get that tribal, he's not from here, you know, type treatment. That's just, I mean, I'm kind of used to that. That kind of, you know, pettiness and being a Methodist pastor and most in a Baptist dominated city, you know, and I'm from outside, you know, it's and I'm a Kappa. So it's just like, I got so many things that isolates me. I have more things that isolates me than unifies a lot of people. So I get it, you know, but that to the side, I mean, I have been doing this City Hall Bible study now for over 2 years. And every Wednesday before City Council meets, going out to bring Bible study to City Hall, inspired by God, right? And one of those Wednesdays, I mean, and in the rain, sleet, hail, and snow, like I just left today and my coat is still wet because it was raining and freezing. My hands have just released being numb because it was so cold outside. I'm an Alabama boy. I'm not used to this Oklahoma weather. One Wednesday, as I was going out to my same post, like to the same exact concrete pillar that comes out of the ground in front of City Hall, there was a group of anti-maskers who were there protesting the city's ordinance that they were passing to make everybody wear masks to keep people alive during COVID, right? Go figure. They didn't want to wear masks. And I always start off every Wednesday saying the same thing. I wasn't even saying anything derogatory. I get up there with my bullhorn with the sign you see behind me and I place it on the pillar and I say the same thing I say every Wednesday. This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Just that caused people to boo, to shout, wow, to yell. People started coming up to me, and don't take my word for it. It's a video on YouTube called Anti-Masks Attack Black Pastor. It's on my YouTube channel. And just that, people start coming at me yelling, jeering, people throwing money, showing credit cards. Mm-hmm. Two white women come and grab me by the arm. Like, I don't know these women. They just came to me and started grabbing me. One of them tried to grab my bullhorn. This white guy throws water on me. Even tough to even talk about now because as I'm talking about it, I'm just reliving it. And I'm out there by myself, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not like a church choir that came with me. I'm by myself, right? I had the guy who drove me there and one guy videotaping. But other than that, it was like me in the lion's den. And I felt the guy throw water on me, and people started laughing at me. And these are grown-ups, right? These are not like middle school teenagers. These are grandparents. These are like parents and so-called leaders in the community. And I just kept speaking. And the troubling part, though, the troubling part was when those white women grabbed my arm. Mm-hmm. Because I'm 6'6". You can't tell by me sitting down. And I kind of have a nice build. I'm not as skinny as I used to be. And I knew that if I had moved my arm, right, just the sheer force from that would have knocked them down. Mm-hmm. Or if I had just raised it, I would have elbowed them. And now I'm the violent person. Mm-hmm. So, doctor, I had to just stand there while those women were grabbing my arm, while those men were yelling in my ear. I mean, one guy came right up in my ear and just started yelling. Mm. And he had a gun. It was also the same guy who threw water on me. Wow. This happened right outside of City Hall. Hmm. And no police officer came out to try to defuse the situation at all. I had to stand there while that was going on, paralyzed. Because if I made the slightest movement and knocked these white women down, they're going to be the victim. And the damsel's in distress. And I'm this angry black gorilla who came down and assaulted these white folks. Same thing they said about the black man who tried to get Dick Rowland out of jail. Mm-hmm. And that was the most paralyzing time of my life. And for a moment, for a small glimpse, mm-hmm. I'm not even trying to liken myself to slaves on the auction block, but for a small glimpse, I got what it felt like. Possibly. It was like something was awakening my DNA. I had genetic memory that I didn't know I had. Like, I had genetic memory of ancestors who were standing on auction blocks, poked and prodded and shackled and couldn't move.
Wow. Wow.
And that resonated. I didn't know I had that genetic memory in my mind. It was just like a strange familiarity came over me. Yeah. And I really felt God cover me and keep me. And so I kept saying what I said. And not deterred, people came up asking me how much I won and am I getting paid for this? Like I get a bonus from the church for every time I go out to City Hall, you know, like that's stupid. And it was ridiculous. It was ridiculous, but just become more determined. And so after that, I went to the church and the first thing I did was, well, actually before I even left, two of the white guys came across the street and said, Pastor Turner, I'm sorry. We see you out here every day. These folks don't know that. And one guy asked me what I was talking about. And I said, 1921 race massacre. And called the city to recognize it is a massacre. Because when I first started on September the 12th, 2018, they were still calling it a riot. Right. So to recognize it as a massacre, as an ethnic cleansing that it was. And then to repent from it. Turn from your wicked ways, your racist ways. And to repay. Right. And I told this white guy that he was like, you know what? I don't see anything wrong with that. I said, well, that's all I was trying to say. Mm. And so I went to the church. He wasn't one of the folks who was yelling at me either. He was just kind of just observing, like, what's going on? And so I went to the church and I prayed the hardest prayer I've prayed in my life. Mm. I prayed to God. I prayed to God that he has mercy on them. And that he actually opens their eyes because they're blinded by hate. And I waited like a full week hoping that that prayer triggered something in any of those people, hoping they would come and apologize, right? Not one of them. Not one of them. So I pressed charges.
We did. Okay.
And to this day, nothing. Wow. And I'm not surprised because this is the city of Tulsa. But meanwhile, that a couple of weeks ago, we had somebody paint BLM on the streets of City Hall. They went after them vehemently, you know, had pictures of the folk who did it and all of that. They got a YouTube video what happened to me. And ain't nobody been arrested. And I gave them names and everything. Wow. And so it just shows you what they choose to prosecute. A black man's life and a black man's safety is not of importance to our city and police department. So, yes, I've received quite a bit. And that's just one incident. I could tell you several others, people coming by the church throwing stuff, thinking they're hitting me, and people yelling and shouting things at me, and people trailing my. It's been ridiculous, but God is protecting me, and I know God is keeping me.
Well, thank you for sharing. Now, is your church the church that was standing in 1921, the last one standing? Is that your church?
Yeah, our basement was built
explain
in 19.
That to the audience. Yeah, explain yeah. that to the audience.
Yeah, our basement started building in 1914, finished in 1919, was built to be the foundation of our superstructure, and that we were trying to build in 1921. That was destroyed in the massacre, but miraculously, the basement underneath survived, and we still use it. I was just walking through there today, so it's still standing. And speaking of some of the things we've just done recently, we've had our church anniversary, 115th church anniversary, right. And we're trying to restore and renovate our sacred space in our basement, especially.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for sharing that trauma. I know how tough, Dr. Adewale. You know, any pushback in school or otherwise with your discussion of this?
No, not really. Definitely nothing to the extent that Dr. Evan Turner has experienced. And I know we're running short on time, so we can quickly go on to Phil.
Okay. Phil, yeah.
Oh, I'm just affirming, you know, the resistance that Reverend Turner, when that came out the next day, it was absolutely horrific, shocking. And as he describes it, you know, a kind of like a genetic, we've been here before type of moment. Occurred for every Black American that, you know, in Tulsa that watched that. It's just amazing, you know, sometimes it's shocking and amazing how quickly people revert to their most basic common element, and that element of fear and just fear and fight and resist. From the mayor, when he announced that, you know, he was going to do something that the previous four or five mayors before him would not do, and take the courage and say, you know, I'm a Republican, but I'm going to take the hit. This is something that needs to be done, and we're going to reopen this investigation. The onslaught of hatred that he received, and even raised private funds for this, so that there was no taxpayer funds to actually support the work. And the just the vitriol, the hate, just for people in a community to say, can we find out what really happened and investigate this and bring it to some closure? Just how much resistance came from that. But at the same time, I will say that there have been so many allies that have awakened anew. The things that's different between when Martin Luther King marched and where we are now is that there are so many other, and I'll just say it, white allies that refuse to watch and say nothing, or pray and go back home and say, oh, that's a shame that they're doing those people like that. The number of white citizens that are coming out and saying enough is enough. We need to say something. We need to say something to other people that look like us, that enough is enough. Let's stand with this community. It's been phenomenal. When Donald Trump announced that he was going to hold his rally here, the week leading up to Juneteenth and the week after, those 2 weeks, the work that the Centennial Commission and others are doing, we had an onslaught of just donations, financial donations that literally came around the world just to say, what can I do just to help support what you're doing, so people know there's a different voice that's there in Tulsa. And that one voice is not the prominent voice. We had over $400,000 in donations come in from everywhere in a 2 week period, just because Donald Trump said, I'm going to do a rally there. And that came from Black citizens, white citizens from around the world. So I think at the same time that there's resistance, there's also, we have to acknowledge how many people are coming to the table to say, I want to be a part of this and help you. I think we have to give that balance on both sides.
And that's really a perfect segue into this next question, which I'm sure folks are really curious about. And Dr. Adewale, I'll actually start with you. But can you provide a broad sense of the current efforts and projects being proposed and or actually implemented regarding reconciliation, burial, mapping, excavation? And then Phil, later on, would you please talk about the museum? But Dr. Adewale, would you mind starting that?
Sure. So I'm leading a project called Mapping Historical Trauma in Tulsa from 1921 to 2021 on behalf of the Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial Commission. And this work is a huge undertaking, a multi-year project, but it is something that starts with literally trying to solve a big problem, in that the history about the massacre and about Greenwood itself, the longer story, is so scattered. We have to first pull together a lot of the scattered information and document where it is right now. So there are collections all over the country that have some sort of collection or historical property that's related to Greenwood. And across this country, there are people who don't have access to this material if they live in Tulsa. So trying to solve that problem was like a first stage of this work. And then developing this WebGIS map that will be online for everyone to use and be able to interact with the shifting footprint of Greenwood and see how Greenwood has been just truncated through time and gobbled up through time after the massacre and connecting it to today. And so connecting the story of Greenwood past to present is a very just taxing project to even be a part of, because it's telling a story of 100 years, and trying to get that story together is literally talking about how we can connect a catastrophic event with a current equally sort of troubling situation for North Tulsa residents who are living an average lifespan of 7 years shorter than everyone else in Tulsa today. So trying to connect this past and present story has been the biggest part of my work, but then the archaeology comes in to search for signs of life. So part of that work is looking for ancestral remains, and the other part is looking for the actual structures, the actual remnants and foundations of built Greenwood. And so that's a larger sort of piece of what I do. But the commission is doing a number of other projects. I'm just one.
Thank you. And Phil, do you want to continue?
Yes, so I'll be really quick on Greenwood Rising. So the 2000, and I can't get into that without giving kind of the inspiration and the why behind. We had several community meetings. I mean, this has been going on since 2015. And let's just be frank, and Reverend Turner can actually attest to this. This has not always been a kumbaya moment. I mean, this community has seen so many promises made, promises broken, promises made, promises broken, from politicians to the city to elected officials over and over. So when the Centennial Commission was formed and comes along and says, you know, we want to acknowledge this history, we want to, you know, see what efforts that we can do. It initially started out as a $5 million, $6 million program to renovate Greenwood Culture Center, completely renovate that facility. As they started going around to different foundation organizations to say, hey, this is what we need to do for the commission, it was the organizations, the foundations, that pushed back and challenged the commission and said, you know what? You have a 100-year anniversary that's coming and you want to do a remodel? That's all you, I mean, you really need to go back, hear from the community, and come up with something that would really be much more substantive than just doing a remodel. That really was a challenge from those who, like, we can raise $6 million, but you have an opportunity to do something very, very great. So that's when the community meetings started going forth and said, well, let's dream this up. We have several memorials already here. We have the 1921 race, it's called Race Riot Memorial, on the memorial in front of the Greenwood Culture Center. That's the memorial to the businesses that were lost, the money lost. We have the John Hope Franklin Park that's been here for 10 years. That monument, beautiful monument in that park, is actually the memorial to lives lost. And what the community really overwhelmingly said, we have enough memorials. Don't just focus on the massacre. Whatever you do, let's tell the world this full history. Talk about the massacre, but talk about Greenwood. Talk about how Black people got to Oklahoma. Talk about their wealth. Talk about how they built this community. Focus on the massacre and give that detail, but then talk about how they rebuilt the community. Let's focus on the entire narrative. And that's when they started saying, we don't have an official place. We have the Greenwood Cultural Center, we have the John Hope Franklin Center, but no place that tells a full immersive history of this. And so that's when the thoughts about what if we built a history center dedicated to this type of history. And that's how that was born. And that's how many ideas and concepts went in. So we're at, you know, 2020, we're right in the midst of the construction campaign. We will build Greenwood Rising. It'll be available and be ready in the midst of 2021. And it's not meant, it's meant to be a place for healing. One of the exhibits in there is called the Journey to Reconciliation. After people experience this history, it's being designed by local projects out of New York City. They designed the 9/11 Museum. They also did significant work with the Legacy Museum in Montgomery, Alabama, with Brian Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative. But when they're, when people are done going through the exhibits, it will lead to a room, an amphitheater style space room, where people will be able to sit and have difficult discussions around race. Programs that are designed towards bringing people together, and let's talk about it. If Greenwood Rising was around today, the number of evening programs we would have hosted to talk about, let's talk about an Ahmaud Arbery shooting. How do you deal with that? A Black man running through a neighborhood and getting shot. How do you deal with all the aftermath of what's happened since George Floyd? How do you, as a city, still reeling and still healing over the shooting of a Terrence Crutcher and how we're still dealing with that? A place to have these discussions so that people who do not look like me can hear my story, hear the life that we live, and get a greater respect and an understanding. We can change all of the laws, we can change, and we can have as many policies as you want. But until you change somebody's heart and mind and how they view you as a person, we're still going to go around this axle. So that's really the exciting part of Greenwood Rising, is that it's going to be dedicated for racial healing, racial trauma, and bringing people together so we really can get on this journey to reconciliation.
Thank you. And Dale, do you want to kind of ask the last question before you all kind of give a brief overview of the various Hall of Fames?
Yeah, just real quick. We just have a few minutes before we go to that. But, you know, really, the crux of it is, how do we help? I mean, how do we help rebuild Greenwood? We're listening. People from around the country are here on online. You know, how do we get the Black businesses back and support you? So anybody can answer that.
It's a big question.
Yep.
I will say I'm pretty much, everybody knows where I stand. I think that we definitely need to look at this thing called reparations, or look at some sort of repair. I think I'm thankful to be, you know, a part of the mass grave excavation. I'm thankful to be on the Race Massacre Commission. And those, both of those are wonderful. But we still need to get to the heart of the matter, that if we truly value Black lives, when Black life is taken, when Black wealth is taken without any due process, there ought to be some recourse. I mean, this happened in America, and especially now with the mass grave excavation, we know bodies were dumped in mass graves. We need to see more than just archaeologists out there now. We need to see some district attorney's office, some FBI, or some criminal investigative body to further look at what is going on, you know, because you can best believe if there was a mass grave full of 300 dead dogs, that the animal rights group would be all over this city. You know, if there were a mass burial of 100 Yellowstone redwood trees, the environmentalists would be all over this issue. But we have 300 dead Black people, and we found a few of their bodies. Why is there no international outcry? And so, to me, in reparations is so much more than a check. It is justice. It is civil as well as criminal investigations and renderings. And so I think that is a part of healing. I do think that, you know, you cannot have true healing or reconciliation without justice, without reparations. That's biblical too. I couldn't be reconciled back to God until Jesus Christ was my reparation, my atonement to pay for my sins. right? You can't have that without the other. And so I think that that needs to be done. And what I would like for Greenwood to look like is, you know, what it was in 1921, as closest to it as possible, which is a self-contained economy where people could live, sleep, eat, shop in their own neighborhood. And I have to travel 20 minutes up the street for basic quality amenities.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well,
yeah, so one of the committees, and probably the committee that will have the most substantive work going forward, is the Economic Development Committee. And Reverend Turner and myself, along with about 30 other representatives from the Centennial Commission in the city, in the early 2019, we took a trip and traveled to Montgomery to kind of give us like what city is doing this now. What can we see as what happens when you coalesce these historical places and what it can do to drive economic robustness. And so we spent a day and a half, and you know, we went to the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, the Lynching Museum, and then the Legacy Museum, the Rosa Parks Museum, Dexter King Avenue Baptist Church, where Martin Luther King got his first pastorate. While we were there, these places, everybody's taking mental notes. And especially when we were at the Dexter King Avenue Baptist Church, and I can't tell it as good as Reverend Turner, but you could just see this is what Vernon AME Church could be. You know, people, you know, they still have church services on Sunday, but it has become a place, a historical place where people come and get this history about Martin Luther King. It's like, you know, what greater place in the United States could it be than this 100-year-old facility that survived a massacre that people want to come to? And so we came back and we said, wow, you know, the difference between that and Tulsa is that we had to get on a bus and had to drive 15 to 20 minutes in between each spot. What we have here is the fact that you can get off your bus or your charter bus or come to Greenwood, and you'll be able to go through the Greenwood Rising History Center, leave there, look at the Greenwood Chamber buildings and see the history there, go straight right up the street from there and walk to Vernon AME Church and get a tour probably, you know, from Reverend Turner. Go across the street and see the 1921 Memorial and Greenwood Culture Center and the Survivors Gallery. Walk across the parking lot, go to Mount Zion Baptist Church, where one of the fiercest fights were taking place, where, as Dr. Ottawali just already talked about, where Black citizens defended themselves. A short walk from there, go to Standpipe Hill, come down Elgin and get to John Hope Franklin Park, and then come around and come right back to where you started. All basically come here and spend the day and see all this history in one place and what it can do to bring economic activity to Greenwood, to the city of Tulsa at large, but more so Greenwood. And so that's kind of like the point that we're wanting to use. Forbes magazine said that the number one economic driver in Montgomery, after a year and a half of being open, was the Legacy Museum and the Lynching Museum. Hotels being built, restaurants being open, all because of building the center. So that's kind of the inspiration to what Greenwood Rising and these things can do for cultural tourism, to bring people here so that they can spend money here, that investment comes back here. You work with the city, you bring economic people to the table, and you start building pools and reservoirs for creative capital and say, now, how do we then plan a master plan community to bring back Black-owned homes and Black businesses in this area and have it specifically tied to a resurgence of Greenwood? It starts with something that brings people here, and then you watch it. So that's like a 3, 5, 10-year trajectory of change that takes place, of economic vitality. And just so that the challenge is to get people to be patient and say, it's coming, you know, it all is taking shape and it's forming, but these things take time to build policy around it. But it is on its way. It's not going to be here in 2021, but it's coming, and educating the community that these are things that are happening and forming and taking shape. 5 to 10, 20 years from now, people are going to come from all over the world, I have no doubt, to come to Tulsa and say, have you been to Greenwood? Do you see what's going on there? I have no doubt that will happen here in a short amount of time.
Well, fantastic. That's well said. Dr. Ottawali, you want to say anything to end before we transition? Oh, you're still on mute.
Yeah, I will say that I agree with everything that both Phil and Dr. Turner said, that we need reparations, but I would also say that we need restorative justice in addition to that. So it's like peeling back those layers of historical trauma and specifically talking about not just paying for financial loss and generational loss, but to also give back land. That means also redrawing the boundaries of Greenwood to what it was at its height. And I talked about the shifting footprint of Greenwood through time, but actually redrawing that boundary and protecting Greenwood. And that means fighting against the encroachment, gentrification, and everything that's happening in downtown right now. So Greenwood is under threat right now. And we need to acknowledge that it wasn't just destroyed once, it was destroyed twice. And I mean, we have to fight for it to continue to rise, as Phil was talking about. So that means not only returning land, but also returning the archives. I mentioned the scattering of the archives being a big problem, returning that history so people can actually have access to that, but also be able to control the narrative for themselves so that the people outside of Greenwood aren't the ones controlling the story of Greenwood. And lastly, I'll say that we definitely need a mandate across the board for K-12 and for college students that this education is taught in our schools, every grade. So it would be wonderful to have that really be an enforced part of every curriculum, but it's going to take a long way to get there. Yeah.
Wonderful.
And thank you for that addition. I definitely coincide with what you all have said, but specifically restorative justice. That's something that's part of my background, and I think something that often gets overlooked. So I'm really glad, Dr. Ottawalle, that you mentioned that. But I do just want to say thank you, Dr. Ottawalle, Phil, and Dr. Reverend Robert Turner, as our panelists, for providing your insights and your involvement in this work. I really appreciate the discussion that you provided us today. And so now, quickly, I'm going to the last 10 or so minutes. I would like to turn it over to Glenn, James, and Sheila. They are the various executive directors of Sheila the Black Tennis Hall of Fame executive director. James is the executive director of the Black Inventors Hall of Fame. And Glenn is the executive director of the Black Entrepreneurship Hall of Fame. To just kind of talk a little bit about each of the Hall of Fames, what their mission is, and kind of next steps on how we can continue to support and promote Black businesses, entrepreneurship moving forward. So I want to say, James, would you like to go first?
Sure. Thank you, Amanda. I want to begin by thanking Dr. Adewale, Phil Armstrong, and Dr. Roberts. It's been an absolute pleasure listening to you. And I have sat here and have become very, very much encouraged by this notion of restorative justice. And Dr. Dale Caldwell and I started the Black Inventors Hall of Fame as a representation of that restorative justice. The restorative justice necessary to call attention to the great contributions of African Americans from day one to the building of this nation. Innovators, inventors. We started the museum, the virtual museum, and the Hall of Fame so that their contributions can be immortalized. And if I can bring something to Mr. Armstrong's attention, is that I am very delighted to know that one of the country's most prolific African-American inventors, George Washington Carver, all right, actually is responsible for naming Black Wall Street by referring to it as the Negro Wall Street when he visited there in 1905. And if you look at the logo that's part of the promotion material that we've been circulating, you'll see the image that was caught that day that he visited as he sat there amongst Black entrepreneurs of Wall Street.
And about Booker T. Washington?
No, George Washington Carver. You're referring to the inventor, George Washington Carver, yes. And so anyway, I'm delighted to know that that's part of the legacy, invention and entrepreneurship. And my brother and partner in crime here, Glenn Best, I am absolutely delighted to know that he has joined me in this pursuit to work in conjunction with you as we celebrate the 100th centennial anniversary. So on that note, Glenn, I'm going to turn it over to you, and you can explain your mission with the Black Entrepreneurs Hall of Fame. Thank you.
Thanks, James. Good evening, Phil, Dr. Adewai, Dr. Roberts. It's a tremendous honor to listen to each of you and to hear this, your stories and your observations and the pathway forward for the Greenwood District. As the executive director for the Black Entrepreneurship Hall of Fame, when Dale founded the organization, obviously we had a specific intent of recognizing and acknowledging the contributions of Black entrepreneurs to the nation, as James mentioned in regarding Black inventors. But we also felt it was important to find a way to have a connectivity between our aspiring Black entrepreneurs, so a connectivity to the present and a pathway forward for the future. I thought it was a brilliant of when Dale first shared with all three of our Hall of Fames the possibility of having our induction ceremony in Tulsa to coincide with the commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the Black Wall Street Massacre. We felt that that was very important to tie that connectivity, that historical context with what we plan to do moving forward. There are many individuals who have joined us this evening who are in the entrepreneurship space, and I'm grateful that they joined us tonight. And we want to be a part in helping Greenwood in reimagining and reestablishing its place there, both in Tulsa and in Oklahoma in general. We look forward to collaborating with your group. We're looking forward to bringing awareness and energy to the celebration in May of 2021. And anything we can do to be of support, we're here to do that. I just wanted to also mention the fact that we often take for granted how many of our Black institutions are involved in entrepreneurship in ways that are often unseen. Dr. Roberts, who's here, the Black church has played a major part in entrepreneurship in all of all the generations of our existence, as have our historically Black colleges. I know, Phil, you said you Central State graduate. I'm also an HBCU graduate at St. Paul's College. And we know that many of the HBCUs have been economic drivers within their own respective communities. That many of the institutions you see across the country have built cities unto themselves in their respective communities using economic development opportunities. So with that being said, we hope to bring that energy from many of our Black institutions to this effort and look forward to working with you. So thank you for Amanda for allowing us to partner in this endeavor. We look forward to the journey and now I'd like to introduce our other colleague, Sheila Curry, director of the Black Tennis Hall of Fame.
Good evening, everyone. Dr. Adewale, Reverend Dr. Turner and Phil Armstrong, it has been a pleasure listening to all of what you all have had to say. I mean, really intriguing. One of the most interesting things is whether it's Glenn or James or any of what you all have said, we basically are all enduring the same things with hidden figures of Black people in history that don't get told in American history. America tells the history of the white persons in America and continues to build on what Black persons have continued to build or to invent or in entrepreneurship, whatever it is, but not to honor those people with what they've done over in the past. What we're doing here at Black Tennis Hall of Fame is to make sure that the history of all of the Black persons that came up with the tennis in behind the scenes is preserved, that they are honored that this history is protected and that the global impact that these Black persons made in breaking barriers and doing all of the things that they did to bring tennis to where it came today, that we make sure that all of that is taken care of. Even we have the pioneers, contributors, players, and the regional legends. We want to cover everybody that has contributed to the sport over the years and make sure that nothing is forgot, that everything is brought forward. And like I said, it's basically everything that we're all saying. All of this needs to come forward. All of this needs to be made history. The American community needs to be educated, and we need to do all of that. One of the most important things that Black Tennis Hall of Fame is doing right now is funding or attempting to fund a virtual museum that will be online and allow anyone that is interested to come in and see what has happened over the years since 1916, when Black persons were not allowed to put a foot on a white court. And they decided to do what we were going to do. Maybe we were halted a little bit with segregation, with racism, but you know how we act to that type of thing. Same journey, new direction, take a new path. And that's what has been done over the years. We just want to share that path. We want to preserve that path and want everybody to know the truth of American tennis history.
Excellent. And just to, May 30th, 2021 is going to be the induction ceremony for the Black Entrepreneurship Hall of Fame and the Black Inventors Hall of Fame. So in Tulsa, we're hoping in person, knock on wood, hopefully in person. And so I just want to thank Amanda. We've thanked everybody else. Amanda Chastang has been phenomenal. Wow. She has really stepped up. She represents the university extraordinarily well. This was really an idea of just a few weeks ago, and we've made it happen with almost 100 people. So Amanda, just thank you very much for this evening. It's your success, not ours. So I'll turn it back over to you.
Amanda, before he gives it back over to you, I want to say measure for measure, it has been no better pleasure than to take part in planning this event along with you and all of my other brothers and sisters today. And Dr. Armstrong, I owe you an apology. Yes, it was the educator Booker T. Washington who may have named it Negro Wall Street, but it was in fact George Washington Carver who was so inspired by the work of the great entrepreneurs on Wall Street that he visited there and took a memorable picture with them. And so many innovators and many entrepreneurs have worked side by side in the same way that I'm working with my brothers here to bring forth that legacy, a legacy that's remembered. Appreciate it. Thank you so much. Amanda, give it back over to you.
I just want to say, again, it has been a true honor working with you, Dale, Glenn, Sheila, and James. And thank you for taking your time, Dr. Ottawale, Dr. Reverend Robert Turner, and Phil Armstrong, for just educating us and allowing us to have a successful first event in Hopewood, which hopes to be a monthly series leading up to an induction ceremony here in Tulsa, as Dale mentioned. So again, I just want to thank you all for taking the time to join us today in this conversation. And thank you to our attendees as well for tuning in. And so I just want to wish everyone a wonderful evening, and we hope to see you all at our next event.